A King's Metamorphosis by K.N. Cole. Historical events of catastrophic magnitude give birth to historical folk tales, in which the fictional characters are made contemporaries with the historical personages of the times. The former are supposed to be eyewitnesses to the events, and so lend credibility to the narrative. In tales such as these, the reader can feel the pulse of the bruised soul of these times, and uncover the raw and bleeding wounds on its body buried deep under the debris of different garbled versions of chroniclers' fiction. Paradoxically, observes and records faithfully the truth at the grassroots level which history, in its cynicism, overlooks. It is correctly remarked that nothing is true in history except names and dates, but everything is true in fiction except names and dates. This fanciful tale centers round one of the illustrious kings of Kashmir, Sultan Zain-ul-Abidin 1423-1474 AD, fondly named Budshah, the Great King, by his loving subjects and remembered with love and reverence by the posterity even to this day. His benign reign spread over half a century, ushered in peace and prosperity, and provided a special healing touch to his Hindu subjects, who had suffered everything that help possessed during the preceding 100 years. A proud and highly civilized race had been vanquished, dispossessed, humbled and disgraced, and finally all but exterminated systematically. Those left alive had, over the years, drawn themselves innards into a protective shell of make-believe prejudices and imbecile morality. It was here in this shell that this folk tale was born, and nursed, and then given to the people, as an opiate, since mind, and not the body, registers feelings. It has to be drugged with fanciful and wishful anecdotes, so as to allow the body and mind to resuscitate. This folk tale of ours is an apt illustration to this fact. What happened during those 100 years or so before Sultan Zain-ul-Abidin appeared on the scene is a tragic saga of evil perpetrated upon the people of the kingdom, who were first let down by their rulers and then forsaken by their luck, starting with the prolonged rape of the entire length and breadth of the valley by Dulaka Orulcha, a Tartar chief from Turkestan, in 1319 AD, who laid waste the land, and another by Achala, another Turkish leader, soon after a year or so ruined its people entirely. What little was left to complete the picture of death and destruction was taken over by Sultan Sikandar 1389-1412 AD, hatefully known as Sikandar Butshikan, the iconoclast, father of Zain-ul-Abidin, assisted by Suhabut, his prime minister, Baneo convert to Islam, assuming the name of Saifuddin. The king, in mad frenzy of skewed religious fanaticism and bigotry, surpassed even the greatest tyrants of history, putting hundreds and thousands of his Hindu subjects, mostly Brahmins, to sword, desecrating, plundering, and destroying all the famous temples and libraries, forcibly converting some to Islam, inflicting all possible cruelties upon them. The king stopped short at nothing. His equally ruthless soldiers, tired of wielding their swords, dragged their hapless victims to the Dul Lake and drowned them in it at a place which is still known by the name of Butta Mazar, meaning the graveyard of the Hindus. Those who yielded got converted. Those who could escape to the subcontinent, but those who resisted perished. To these people it must have been impossible to believe that a Muslim king, and the son of an arch-tyrant Sultan Sikandar, at that could be so generous, so kind-hearted, secular and large-hearted, as to allow them the same freedom and privileges as his Muslim subjects enjoyed. The only explanation for this incredible phenomenon that could readily occur to them must have been the intervention of some divine or supernatural power affecting the thinking and psyche of the king. This tale that has mystified its hero has come down to us in the shape of this folk tale. Here it is. The day was sullen, as before. Sable gray clouds behaved like unwelcome guests having come to stay. Late winter seemed to linger on in the valley, adding to the woes of the people. The morning brought no let up in the weather. Pandit Shribut, a local Ved physician sitting in the ground floor room of his house, which served as his clinic, was pulling hard at his haka hubble bubble while feeling the pulse of one of his patients, the charcoals, in the chillum, the small earthen Potop the Hukka refused to ignite. In disgust, he threw down the long wooden pipe and hurriedly scribbled a prescription for the patient. His face was anxious and worried. Apparently, he had something on his mind. He had received the other day, through one of his Muslim friends, a courier, a detailed report about King Zainul Abidin's illness, and also the inability of all the royal physicians to cure him. He was anxious to prove his worth as a physician, and his friend had already recommended his name to the king. He was asked to reach the palace at noon that day, and now that he had finished with his patients, he took his medicine box with him and left for the palace. The guard at the palace gate escorted Shribut to the main building. Here silence prevailed everywhere and men and soldiers talked in hushed tones. The king's illness had engulfed everyone with deep anxiety. Even the appearance of a brief sun winking coldly behind the clouds did not remove some of the gloom. Straightening the loose folds of his gown, he walked with light foot, trying to avoid the sound of his footfalls. Presently he found himself at the doorstep of the king's bedroom. Shribut, head bent, approached the vast bedstead upon which the king was reclining. Two royal physicians were changing the bandage of his infected wound, which a sinister-looking boil at his back had turned into. Saluting the sultan, he stood at a respectful distance. The royal physician addressed the king. "Your Majesty, Shribut is here. May we give him a try?" The sultan made a noise of disgust. "Do what you think best, Shribut. We are in great pain," he said, throwing the back of his hand to him. A chill caution of a trained physician entered Shribut's mind. He unbandaged the wound and touched lightly the skin round it, which looked red and tender. He applied some medicine on it, covering it with a bit of cotton wool, and then bandaged it securely. "Tonight your Majesty will enjoy sound sleep, and within 3 days, God willing, sit up completely cured," he addressed his king. The king's emaciated face gave back a bald and bland smile in reply. That night, in the fenceless borderland between sleep and wakefulness, the king felt his back relieved of much of the pain, and it was late in the morning when he opened his eyes, feeling refreshed after peaceful sleep. Whether it was the efficacy of Shribut's medicine or his good fortune that did the trick, none can tell, but after a few days the king, completely cured, did attend the court, as predicted by Shribut, sitting on his throne. He looked around for his benefactor, and spotted him standing in a corner. He motioned him to his presence. Words came to him slowly, as if he had to choose from a difficult dialect long forgotten. Short pauses in between expressed his gratefulness more eloquently than the words he spoke. The king asked Shribut to name anything in the world, and that would be granted to him. Shribut expressed his gratitude for the magnanimous offer, and said that His Majesty's recovery was all that he desired. Prompted by the king to speak out his mind, as he was keen to do something for him, Shribut kept silent. He felt like a prize winner who does not know how to carry his unwieldy trophy home. The king's eyes bored into his face, as if trying to find a path leading to his mind. This time Shribut looked straight into his eyes, and saw in them a deep sea of generosity. Encouraged by the stately inclination of his head, and the indulgent smile playing on his lips, he prayed that his Hindu subjects be let off the hook of tyranny and religious persecution, so that their honor and religious freedom could be restored. Pleased with the reply, the king granted him his wish with a nod. That day, after the darbar was over, Shribut, walking along the narrow paths leading to his home, felt a strange, insidious warmth engulfing his being after a long, long time. A flirting wind brushed his face lightly, as if in thanksgiving on behalf of his suffering brethren. Tears of relief welled up in his heart and dribbled down his beard. The single streak of good fortune was God's last gift to Shribut, as the king, after some time, was again down with a disease with this time neither he nor the royal physicians could diagnose or cure. Each day that passed seemed to sap his life force, drop by drop, inch by inch. Demented with prolonged fever, the king looked prematurely senile and his face took an ashen hue. His royal head, once so robust and youthful, looked inadequate even to support his beard. Gloom enveloped the city, and the desperate people prayed for divine mercy. Shrivatsa's failure to find out an effective cure for the king's illness made him desperate. He was weighted down by great anxiety. He loved his king and did not want to lose him. Now his reputation as a physician was at stake, but more than that, the decrees issued by the king had not been yet implemented. His untimely demise would undo all that he had achieved so far. That day Shrivatsa went for an early dip at the Vitastava direct from the palace, where he had spent the whole night beside the king's bed. It was pre-dawn, and the bathing ghat was deserted. Only a lonely star beamed at him from the sky. While on way back he saw a figure approaching him. It was a sadhut, 6 foot 2, and Shrivatsa had not seen a sadhut in the city for a long time. Folding his hands in reverence, he touched his feet. The sadhut's dim profile was now discernible in the early light of the dawn. His head, with long matted hair, thick as so thatch, matched perfectly with his long flowing beard, but the sight of his bloodshot eyes giving out flares of hate gave him goose flesh. "You are the first Brahmin that I have seen since yesterday. I have been roaming all day and night to find a temple for a day's rest, but I have not seen any. Have my eyes deceived me?" he said to Shrivatsa without any preliminaries. Shrivatsa looked at him like a bird that has been shot, and parrying the question requested him to accept his hospitality. As his house was just nearby, at home he offered him some food and sat before him, not knowing how to explain the disaster that had overtaken the place and its people. Obviously the sadhut did not belong to those parts and had come from the south of the subcontinent. He summed up briefly the tragedy that had overtaken his people and told him about the desperate situation he was in at the moment. The sadhut listened with rapt attention with his eyes closed. "Your king has finished with this world, and there is nothing one can do now," he said. "But the promise he made to relieve my people of their miseries will soon be forgotten. Justice will not then be done. If only the king could live for a few months more," Shrivatsa said, throwing his hands in despair. Something lit up the sadhut's face. He opened his eyes and pulled viciously at his beard, as if to soften the impact of the idea that had hit him like a bolt. He opened up in measured tones. "Listen carefully. I can animate your king by my own Atman. 400 days immediately after he breathes his last, I hope that much time should be enough to get your plans in action. During that time I shall be leaving my mortal shell here, and you must promise to preserve it safely for me." It took some time for the strange scheme to sink into Shrivatsa's mind. He thought the sadhu was playing a cruel joke on him, but the tone of the sadhu's voice reassured him. His Adam's apple moved convulsively. He looked him up and down, not knowing what to say. Shrivatsa changed gear. "Am I not putting you to a great risk? What if something unusual happens?" "No, no, it is asking too much," he said, hovering between despondency and hope. Without answering back, the sadhu now sat cross-legged and closed his eyes softly. He did not even wait to elicit from Shrivatsa the assurance asked for, and went into a deep trance. Slowly his breathing stopped altogether, and he looked like a statue. Shrivatsa traced out of the room, locking it up from outside. He flew to the palace and went straight into the king's bedroom. He found the king's face deathly pale, cold sweat dotting his brow. Presently his whole body convulsed, and he fumed out a long sigh and lay still and stiff. The king was no more. Shrivatsa was all eyes now. He wanted to be the witness to the miracle promised by the sadhut. Yes, the miracle did occur. The king's face began to regain its color, and very soon his body began to move. He asked for water in a feeble voice for the first time after many days. The sadhu's soul had taken over, while that of the king had made its tryst with his maker. Shrivatsa was now fully convinced that the sadhu's soul had animated the body of the king, but it would take more than 100 days for the king to regain his shattered health completely. The period was too short to get his plan implemented. A thought, a blend of devilment and intrigue, passed through his mind. If the sadhu's body is disposed of for good, his soul would remain stay put where it is now. Better to cremate him here and now than risk our future, he argued with his conscience, and his conscience agreed with what he proposed, so he got the Sadha's body cremated with due religious ceremonies in his own presence, and earned the gratitude of his people. As the pyre got engulfed in flames, Shrivat was heard saying to himself, "After all, in the end, it is nothing, but the ashes for every one of us, tomorrow if not today, why not today?" Up above in the evening sky a faint honking of the wild geese seemed to echo his thoughts, as if saying, "Yes, we know."